Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Flo. I'm part of the team behind The Power Test. And each week, The Debrief is our listeners' chance to discuss everything about the latest show and look at where we go next to change Britain for the better. Bit like Love Island's After Sun or Big Brother's Little Brother, but instead of fake tan and the diary room, is a bunch of political nerds basically just discussing the latest episode of the pod.
We're live every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Spaces over at The Power Test on Twitter. Make sure you're subscribed to get a reminder and all the latest from the team and much more.
Welcome to The Power Test. I'm Aisha Hazarika.
And I'm Sam Friedman.
So, Sam, since we last convened, you've been a right globetrotter. You've been a right Judith Chalmers. Tell us what you've been up to.
Well, I'm not quite sure about that comparison, but I have been with my family in Italy. I was in Rome and I was in Naples, desperately trying to get my children to experience a bit of culture in between looks at their phones. But
Sam, you were probably the worst person on your phone.
I'm a terrible example to them. Now, we did manage to get them to look at some ruins, actual ruins, not just me, after a couple of glasses of wine. So yeah, we had a very nice time. And I was always a bit worried about this holiday because we booked it ages ago and I kept thinking, please don't have a May election. Please don't have a May election. But luckily we avoided that. So I got my holiday.
Now, listen, I've been very worried about the food situation because you just eat McDonald's and terrible food. How did you cope in Italy? Did your taste buds have a sort of like revolution with all this beautiful Italian food? Have you renounced your McDonald's now?
I wasn't allowed to go to McDonald's because my wife won't let me go on holiday to McDonald's, which is very disappointing. I always like to try McDonald's in different countries because there's always exciting differences between them.
Stay tuned for Sam's next book.
We had to eat, you know, like really great pastas and amazing Neapolitan pizza and that kind of stuff. I was really hard done by. The highlight for me was I'd never had before was sea urchin spaghetti, which I would strongly recommend to anybody in if you're visiting Italy.
And just when you think The Power Test could not get any more metropolitan elite.
Yes, this is the Liz Truss's enemies in full flow. Me sitting in the Italian coast eating sea urchin pasta.
Like you people. You
vile elites I am, yes.
You people bringing down the will of the people with your sea urchins. Now, look, obviously on this podcast, we muse a lot about the Labour Party. And of course, we spend a lot of time talking about the big figures in the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, Rachel Reeves, Wes Streeting, the kind of big guns in the shadow cabinet. But of course, anybody who knows politics knows that the power behind the throne is really, really important in politics. And there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes in the Labour Party and across the Labour movement. And there's a very interesting new outfit which has gathered a lot of interest. They're called Labour Together. And they are an increasingly influential think tank. And we want to sort of shine a bit of a light on them today because I know you all are interested in knowing who's kind of shaping the Labour Party policy, culture, style, and Labour Together is really important. Tell us a bit about them, Sam.
Yeah, so this was initially set up really as a campaign organisation to get someone to replace Jeremy Corbyn, who was going to plausibly win an election. And it was, you know, run by Morgan McSweeney, who is now running Labour's election campaign and is one of Starmer's closest advisors. So it's very, very close to Keir Starmer and always has been. It's very different from a normal think tank. It doesn't pretend to be non-partisan. It's not a charity. It's very clearly affiliated with the Labour Party. And it doesn't actually publish a lot of the work it does, because a lot of what they're doing is about sort of behind the scenes support for the development of Labour's manifesto and Labour's plans for government. So they can seem a little bit shadowy, and they sort of come up, they pop up in the newspaper articles and columns every now and again. And I can imagine our listeners might have seen their name and think, who are these guys? They're really well resourced. They've got some really impressive people working for them, some of whom at least are likely to go and work for a Labour government. And a lot of the work they're doing, a lot of the ideas that they're having, are really shaping Labour's messaging, the way they're talking, their sort of securenomics and security focus of a lot of their messaging as well. So understanding who Labour Together are, what they're doing and how they're thinking about politics is going to be really important to understanding how Labour might sort of behave after an election.
So let's have a listen to our conversation with Josh Symonds, who is the director of Labour Together.
Welcome to our guest for this episode, Josh Symonds. Tell us a bit about your think tank, Labour Together, where it came from and what your sort of focus is at the moment. I think it has a bit of a reputation for being a bit of a power behind the scenes for Keir Starmer. So give us the true story.
Well, Labour Together is an unusual kind of thing because we're not a charitable think tank. We don't profess to be cross-party. We don't profess to be politically neutral. We're very clear about who we want in power and who we want to be governing well, and that's the Labour Party. And that is partly a function of our history. We've had a consistent and quite simple mission all through our history, which is that we want to help Labour win and govern well.
And how are you funded?
One of the consequences of us being a political organisation is that we are registered with the Electoral Commission, we're regulated by the Electoral Commission, and all of our political donations are declared to the Electoral Commission. The great strength of that is that because we're funded by political donors, we can do political work without having to be subject to the constraints of being a charity or being a for-profit company. And I think, you know, if you sort of take a step back for a moment, my view is that we live in a very political age, and it's therefore very hard for organizations who are working with political parties to be useful if they are subject to constraints that make them have to sort of bury and obfuscate and hide politics that are really there.
Mm. And you've had a few issues about declaring donations. What's happened there, just so we're fully transparent?
Well, the fine that we received from the Electoral Commission was relating to a period that was before I took over and well in the past. And, you know, we actually notified the Electoral Commission of what we thought was a failure to declare. We were fined, that case was concluded, and, you know, that's been that. What it did, though, was actually prompt us to ask the question, what kind of entity are we, and how can we be transparent about the kind of work that we're doing? So some of the procedures we have in place and some of the processes we have in place as a consequence of that have been incredibly useful and been productive in saying, you know what, we're going to take a different kind of approach here to most organisations in Britain. We're not going to try and pretend that we are neutral about who forms the next government. We're not going to show up to every party conference just to sort of do our pretend homework on looking cross-party. Actually, we're just going to be upfront and say, we believe that the Labour Party is the party that has working people's interests at its heart now, and therefore we're going to declare our donations to the Electoral Commission.
I guess one of the sort of functions of you being this kind of different type of organisation that's more overtly political is that you have a similar tension to the one that Labour's dealing with at the moment, which is they're simultaneously trying to campaign to win an election and think about the right messaging to do that, and also think about governing after an election that they are likely to win. Those two things don't necessarily lead you to the same conclusions all the time. And in a lot of your work, you're trying to think about policy, but you're also trying to think about the messaging that goes with that policy and how you sell it to an electorate. How do you balance that tension in your work?
The connection between those things, politics and policy, thinking about the tensions, the overlaps, how each informs the other, that is the productive space that makes, I hope, what we do, mostly in private, useful. The tension can be overdone a little bit because it's really about how your political incentives change at different political moments. So right now, you know, this election will be a referendum on the government. That's a perfectly legitimate type of election to fight after 14 years. That will change very quickly because at that point, the electoral coalition that Labour will have, which to a large degree will be about conservative 2019 voters either staying at home or registering their protest by voting for the Reform Party, Labour will then have to bind and unify its own electoral coalition rather than benefiting from the complete implosion of their opponents. All over the world, Biden, Albanese, you know, Schultz, these leaders tended to win elections after the basically populist right, who were their opponents, had imploded in government. So the centre-left won, not really because it had a sort of neatly worked out political project, but because their opponents completely imploded. And that poses the political question, what does it mean to govern from the centre-left in a way that is focused on winning an election after one way you've benefited from the implosion of your opponents? And that, I think, is the central political question if Labour are lucky enough to win the next election.
And what's the answer to that question? Because that is the question that we're all mulling over. And you make a really, really good point that we have seen centre-left governments come in. They're often one-term centre-left government. And as you say, Biden's done a really good job, but it's somehow not cutting through. Let's see how he does at the election. But that is the big question. That's the question that we ponder heavily on this podcast. How does Labour not just win, but change Britain for the better in a very harsh fiscal climate?
I think the bottom line is that you have to be political about how you govern. Delivering on policy in and of itself is not enough. We think that if we identify, you know, 10 big policies and then we do them, job done. Voters will somehow feel it and will notice those 10 big policies. And then, you know, we can all go home and voters will reward us and that's how you win the next election. It really overestimates how much working people in Western democracies who have voted for the populist right but can be won back, how disconnected they are from the sorts of levers that you can pull in Parliament or in Whitehall. The central thing that you need to do is put the experience of working people, people who are economically insecure, people who are politically disengaged, at the heart of everything you do in government. That, I think, means looking at metrics and thinking about what data you care about differently. I think it means thinking about the design of policy in terms of storytelling and not just sort of technocratic things like, you know, aggregate GDP. And I think it means thinking really carefully, more carefully than people who were around pre-97 tell me they were thinking, about sequencing, what you do in what order.
Give us a bit of an example of what you're talking about. Labour Together recently did a report on immigration, which is sort of a really good example, I guess, of an area where they have struggled to tell the kind of story that you're telling to the kind of voter that you're talking about. And there is a real tension within the voter coalition that you talk about between being able to tell that story to voters who might be attracted by reform or the populist right, and perhaps sort of younger progressive activists, Labour supporters who are very pro-immigration and see current government policy as being an outrage, and Rwanda as being an outrage. Tell us a bit about how your report tried to find a way through that, I guess.
In some ways, the language of finding a way through is part of where we need to start and kind of pause and think about if that's what we really want to do when it comes to something like migration. The first fundamental starting point has to be that democracies since the ancient Athenians have essentially depended on the citizens of a country being able to say who else becomes a citizen of the country, who else is going to be part of the demos, who else is going to join this self-governing group of people. And rather than engaging with that point and saying, well, that's true, but in the modern world, we have to give up some of that basic old democratic right in order to grow our economies faster, trade effectively, whatever it might be, that premise was never really accepted. And I think that's a real mistake, because the basic intuition is our government needs to have control over our borders, and the people that we vote for need to have the power to decide who else becomes a member of our democracy. That is not a policy design, it's a principle. But it's a principle that I think the centre-left have not done a good enough job communicating, that they understand is a moral principle that working people in this country feel has not been understood by political elites. And unless you start there, you're not going to get anywhere.
And I think you make a powerful point, because there's always been the accusation amongst some in the Labour Party that you're just all for open borders and, you know, anybody who even talks about immigration is racist. But then the policy details are important. I mean, you got into a tiny bit of hot water by suggesting that the government should put people smugglers on a barge and ship them to the north of Scotland. Is that a kind of thing of showing that you're being tough on immigration, but then maybe the policy thing went a bit far?
Well, the point I was driving at there is that we are punishing the wrong people. You're punishing innocent people who are, you know, fleeing war and persecution. The Conservative government are trying to demonstrate that they're tough on controlling borders by putting those people on barges. So they're punishing the wrong people. The people they should be punishing are those exploiting people who are fleeing war and persecution which is the gangs.
Why Scotland? Scotland's, as a Scot, Scotland is beautiful. Come to Scotland, but maybe don't send the people smugglers to Scotland.
Scotland was, you know, there's no way of putting it other than a total mistake. I was I was panicking in the middle of an interview and thinking, I need somewhere that has lots of coastline and is far from where the barge currently is, which is in the south of England. So that's how you get to Scotland. Scotland was clearly not thoughtful policy, and I hugely regret saying that.
Well, good for admitting it. But look, I think the really important thing is, and I do support a lot of what you say. I mean, I remember being in Labour Party meetings in the run-up to between 2010 and 2015, and people just saying, let's not talk about immigration. Like, we don't want to talk about it because it's too controversial, and nature abhors a vacuum, and we know the end of that sort of story. But Josh, I suppose the thing is, knowing that immigration is an important issue, and I'm not one of these progressive people that say, oh, no, don't talk about it. You can hold two things in your mind at the same time as a normal working person. You can hold the state of the economy and the NHS, and you can also worry about immigration. That doesn't make you like a bad person. But I think one of the challenges that I think Labour spokespeople will have, particularly in the run-up to the general election, is people are worried about this. They see the boat crossings going up. They've heard all the snake oil stuff from the Conservatives. They're completely losing trust and faith in politics because of immigration with the Conservatives. They are looking to something from the Labour Party. And I completely get your point about messaging, but the public are also quite canny. They're also like, the messaging is important. The body language is important. Not calling us all racist is important. But we also want to hear something of a plan.
Yeah. The first thing is not to underestimate how far Labour have come already on this. Labour are more trusted on migration now. They're more trusted to control our borders than the Conservative Party. And that has not been true. I can't remember the exact...
It's never been true, not for a sustained amount of time. There was one or two polls about 20-odd years ago when Blair was his absolute peak, but it's never been sustained until now.
Exactly. So that is a big, big deal. Because that is the public saying, very few people are across the sort of really wonky details, but they are listening to what Labour are saying about controlling our borders, and they're saying, okay, we trust you. That's not the same as saying, we don't trust them. They're saying, we trust you more than them.
But I guess once Labour are in government, even if they are able to do a better job at managing the borders than the current government, they're not going to be able to completely end the flow of immigration into the UK. And almost whatever the level is, you're going to have parties like Reform, people like Nigel Farage, saying it's far too many people coming in. So it's sort of one thing to win that initial trust. I guess it's another to be able to hold it through the actual challenges of being in charge of a system in which there is inevitably going to be a certain level of immigration, and probably a higher level than there was 10 or 20 years ago, simply because of the nature of the modern world. So how do you, I guess, sustain that position and argument so that it doesn't just come back as a big populist winning argument in 5 years' time?
Yeah, if I could fully answer that question, I would have solved one of the great questions for any centre-left government all over the world. You know, when we did this review of these centre-left governments who benefited from the implosion of their opponents and then struggled in government, migration and borders is the thing that centre-left governments confront because it is a permanent feature of our world and then struggle with politically. One of the reasons why I'm a bit obsessed with the citizenship agenda is because it has clarity and simplicity. You are or you are not a citizen of a country. And one of the problems in this country, I think, is that the status of those who live in this country and their relationship to voting, to paying taxes, to working, is very complicated. And there are many versions of how all of those things fit together. And I really think that a lot of trust can be won by simplifying who gets to become a citizen, how, and what their obligations are, both while they're a citizen and before they're a citizen. The other thing I would say is that, to Aisha's question before as well, we can't duck the underlying question here, which is about the future shape of the British economy. And right now, our economy grows essentially because our population grows. GDP per capita, you know, is not meaningfully changing, even as the size of our economy is growing. We might be fine with that. Bigger economies, bigger populations, you know, there are all sorts of benefits to that. Bigger tax take, you know, more sort of geopolitical power. So there's all sorts of reasons why we might want to keep that model. But if we don't, what we need to do is move to a higher productivity, higher wage economic model. That has implications for the need of our economy for low wage inward migration. And I think that in government, it is much easier is almost certainly not the right word, but you can take on that really big fundamental question. And I think we have to. essentially leveling with the public and saying, we have a choice about the economic model we build. You know, it's not at our fingertips, but we can take steps to shift model if that's what we want. Mm. This is what that looks like. And this is the implications for migration.
And look, I think that is absolutely the big challenge. It is for the next Labour government, whoever wins the next election. And this is what Brexit was meant to have delivered. You know, it's shaping what you want the economy and the society to look like. I suppose the question is, if Labour comes in and as Keir Starmer has indicated that he does want the country to wean itself off, you know, cheap imported labour, that does come at a cost and there will be trade-offs to that. There will be long-term advantages to that if it can be married with a very fulsome regional skills strategy. We spoke with Nick McPherson and he said that was very, very important. That all costs a lot of money. You can't just put a skills strategy in place for beans. But in the short term, there will be some pain, a bit like the reality after Brexit. There will be some pain if you're going to constrict immigration, things like the care sector, agriculture, hospitality. How do you compel British people to take those jobs that historically people don't want to do? Will Labour be prepared to take some really tough and quite unpopular decisions, like, for example, saying we're going to be really tough on benefits unless you fill these jobs that migrant labour would have done? Because that's quite a big challenge for Labour to do. There'll be a lot of opposition to that from the public in some quarters, from within the movement. Are those the tough decisions that you think Labour needs to be prepared to address?
In short, yes. The success of a Labour government, if Labour win, depends on making those choices, in a nutshell. And, you know, when we've looked at centre-left governments around the world who've really struggled, it's often because, for one reason or another, they have not been willing to confront and make and then communicate those choices. One really good example of this is there's often chatter now about all the first 100 days and what's Labour's plan to hit the ground running and how's Labour going to make sure that everyone's excited by a new Labour government and so on. Some of that conversation, I think, is at slight risk of distracting from Labour's capacity to lay the groundwork for those kinds of tough choices. After the 2010 election, what the Conservative Party did was blame a global financial crisis on the Labour Party. That was their story for I don't know how many years.
Still is.
Right. And I think that in some ways, the early phase of the next Labour government has to not be about the Labour Party and not be about the Labour government in some ways. And it has to be about, you know, the state of the country. It has to be about why the country's in the mess that it's in. It has to still be about the Conservative Party. And I think the interesting thing is that because the impatience to change the country is so strong from within the Labour Party, that's why it's a great thing. There will be so many voices saying, okay, what are you going to do? What's your plan for this? How are you going to deal with that? What's your big piece of legislation on, you know, day four and so on? And actually, the focus needs to be, in terms of storytelling, on explaining just how bad the state of our country is in a whole number of myriad different ways.
Josh, I totally agree that Labour has to. And to be fair, Labour has been doing that. I think one of the reasons why Labour has been doing very, very well is, yes, the Tories are completely imploding and things are going very badly in the country. But Labour has converted that into a very effective attack line in terms of 14 years of failure. But I think the public will also expect, if one of the big messages from Labour is, look, this is the change election, this is a chance to change Britain for the better, people also do have an expectation and a bit of a right to know, okay, well, what is the change? And I think where the difficulty is, and I suppose this is the stuff you're wrestling with, is there is going to be a really big yearning from the public to feel optimistic. They've had so much misery. Everything has been ground down. Broken Britain is like a lived experience for people around the country. They know it's not 1997. They know there isn't a lot of money, but they want a bit of optimism. They want a little bit of hope.
The short answer, I think, to your question is, it's not so much a balance as a process and a sequence of moving from it's tough, it's all their fault, to here's our solution to these problems. That's a journey that you have to go on, you know, together as a country, in a sense. And Keir Starmer's job is to take the country on that journey and not just jump from it's all crap to here's what we're going to do about it. Don't worry, you know, life's going to be better. When we've looked at this in quite a lot of detail, people are very, very, very skeptical that anything that politicians say and do makes any difference to their lives. And that trust is so, you know, it's one of the big differences between 1997 and now. Trust in politics, trust in politicians, a sense that politics matters to my life, is so much lower and so much more broken than it was before 1997. And rebuilding that trust is a process, and it's slow and it's delicate and it's so important.
But does Labour have time, Josh? Because 4 or 5 years whisks by, You have to start pitch rolling for the next election, 2 years out of the next general election. The Scottish elections, our friends in Scotland, where we're not sending the people smugglers to, they're going to have Holyrood elections coming up soon. The Labour government will have to have shown some kind of delivery. But I get your point about the 100 days, and it is a bit of a trite. It's a bit of a cliche that the idea you're going to like change Britain in 100 days is just naive. But there, you know, people are going to start looking at the clock and the calendar and going, hang on a minute, what's going on? We need to see something happening.
Put it this way, I think we're far more likely to win the election after next if we over-deliver and under-promise than if we over-promise and under-deliver.
I want to change tack a bit and talk about the team of people who will be trying to do what you're describing and deal with some of these massive challenges. And some of the people around Starmer who perhaps don't get much attention because they shouldn't be getting attention because they're advisors, they're not sort of elected politicians. But we know from previous governments that those people in senior positions and what they think can be incredibly important to how a government plays out. Now, Labour Together was set up by Morgan McSweeney, who's currently running the Labour campaign. Tell us a bit about how he thinks and works and his politics and how he is approaching some of these questions and how he's working with Starmer and the wider team around him.
Well, we as an organisation work closely with most of the senior figures around Keir and in the Labour Party, Morgan being one of the most important ones when it comes to the next election. One of the interesting things about Morgan's history is that he cut his teeth, and to some extent this is true of Keir too, fighting populists on the left and on the right, Barking and Dagenham fighting the BNP, the Corbynite hard left within the Labour Party. You know, you often hear Keir talk about the politics of power and not protest. What does that mean? It means what I will never be is a populist. And what do I mean by a populist? A populist is somebody who takes seriously grievances, anxieties, you know, an actual failure to deliver for working people for a very long time, takes seriously that problem and then promises things that are never going to solve that problem and doesn't take seriously actually solving that problem. Keir and Morgan hate that, and both have seen up close what it means to be a kind of populist on the left and the right who doesn't actually care about fixing the problems that they use politically. So I think it's quite an interesting thing that background of fighting and beating populism and hating, frankly, how a certain kind of populism sells working people down the river is a big part of the kind of skills and temperament that might be needed after the next election if the Conservatives lose and then, you know, implode inwards and move to the right.
I guess one of the most intriguing tensions I find about Starmer himself and some of the people around him is that, you know, what you're saying is clearly true. He has almost this kind of anti-politics view of things in that he sort of hates a lot of the tricks and noise around politics and the triviality of it. And you know, he very clearly genuinely was very angry at Boris Johnson and the way he was sort of behaving and the way he sort of made promises he couldn't hope to keep. At the same time, they have used some of those political tricks themselves in order to fight those people. So there's a sort of question of sort of how do you reconcile sort of Starmer's kind of seriousness in a way and his sort of institutionalist mindset, almost a civil service way of thinking on one side, and a kind of political ruthlessness on the other side that he's shown and he's had to show in order to get to the position that he's in. And how do you sort of balance those two sides of him in a way that seem in contradiction with each other almost?
I don't think that we should allow ourselves to think that ruthlessness is a virtue of populists in politics and only populists. You can be ruthless and responsible in politics. In fact, you should be, both of those things. They are both virtues that successful political leaders will need. If Keir can continue to display both of those virtues, we may well be in for a great prime minister if Keir wins the next election.
But he's also been willing to switch positions. It's not just about being tough. It's also, you know, he told a story to Labour members who had previously been in favour of Corbyn. That was way to the left of where he is now and where the party is now.
But that's just winning. That's not populism. That's just
It's not populism, but it isn't being completely honest with the people who were voting for him. Or at very least, if he was being honest, then he changed his mind when he needed to change his mind. So there's an element where he's not just ruthless in the sense of firing people when he needs to fire them, but is ruthless in the sense of changing position when he needs to change position, which is a very political skill. And whilst at the same time, he also seems to be quite sort of disdainful of politics and dislike that kind of aspect of politics.
Yeah, and I do think it's important to separate this question of populism and what it means to beat populists from the question of, are you sort of anti-politics or, you know, and I hate this narrative about somehow Keir doesn't like politics and he's not good at politics. I mean, for goodness sake, how successful does Keir Starmer have to be as a politician until people drop the idea that he's not very good at politics? Winning means building electoral coalitions, whatever your electorate is, building coalitions within that electorate that are bigger than your opponent. That's what winning is. And if you can't do that in politics, then you're in the wrong business. I am not going to shed any tears over the fact that Keir Starmer won the last Labour leadership election and then transformed the Labour Party into a professional, outward-looking machine.
So, Josh, let's talk about the manifesto. Is Labour Together producing a lot of ideas for the manifesto? How is the manifesto process going to work in terms of Labour Together? Obviously, there's lots of good people at Labour Together. Is the expectation that you're going to see this big kind of migration of Labour Together staffers who become special advisers in big government departments and in Number 10 if there's a Labour victory?
Well, the manifesto process happens completely within the Labour Party. So I don't know which of the submissions that we've sent in have made it into the manifesto. I hope that lots of them have, because I think they're good, but I don't know. So when it actually comes to the manifesto process, you know, we are very similar to other think tanks in, you know, generating ideas about policy and then submitting them into the process. And then Labour internally decide what goes into the National Policy Forum process and then what goes into the manifesto. People often ask me, is half of Labour Together going to go into government? And obviously, I have no idea about the answer to that question. But I think it slightly weirdly underestimates, you know, I'm really excited for the future of Labour Together. I think this question of how centre-left governments win after they've, you know, assumed the reins of government, I think it is such an important political question that no centre-left party really around the world has actually quite, you know, gotten their heads around yet. How do you govern from the centre-left in an electorally successful way in this uncertain, kind of insecure age? I hope we will keep doing that long beyond the next election.
That's a really important point, actually, because I could understand there would be a desire for lots of people to immediately go and get a nice job in government. But you do make an important point. If there is a Labour government, it's going to face a lot of challenges, as you've set out. And actually, what was probably really important for a Labour government is to have a good think tank on the outside supporting the work and coming up with ideas, because it does feel that the right in politics has done better in terms of having those right-wing think tanks. I mean, you can agree and disagree with what you think they've come up with, but they have provided quite interesting architecture to support politicians in government, and the left just hasn't really done that.
I'm thinking back to 2009, 2010, when I was in Policy Exchange, and it got completely sort of denuded of people. We all went into government, and it sort of fell apart a bit, and I don't think Policy Exchange ever actually recovered from that moment. And certainly for that first five-year period during the first government, there wasn't actually much on the outside providing support, and I think it was a loss. If you can keep thinking going on outside government, because that thinking in government is very difficult to do because you're just being bombarded by day-to-day crap all the time. So having some people actually able with a bit of space outside is pretty important.
You've both seen this up close. Personally, I haven't, but I've talked to the people who have, and they all say, you know, what's really hard to make time for in government is politics. Sort of ironically, given that you're in government, there's just such a, you know, volume of decisions and information and, you know, crises and so on, that actually the sort of big picture, the politics, the strategy, the storytelling, you know, the relationship that you have with voters, that can kind of strangely sometimes fall under the rug a little bit. And I think if Labour Together can continue to be a home, a driving force, provide the information, the research, the data for that thinking and those conversations to be had, that is a really important contribution to the future of the centre-left in this country. And every stakeholder that I talk to understands the need for that and is excited for that to happen.
Okay, we're going to move on to our three quick-fire questions that we're asking everybody. So the first one is, we want your contribution to our fantasy cabinet that we're building up by talking to everybody. So who's the one person, they can be dead, alive, real or fictional, who you're adding to Keir Starmer's first cabinet, and what role are you giving them?
Yeah, well, I hate to pull back the curtains, but I don't know if your listeners know that we get these questions in advance. I always think it's funny in podcasts that you sometimes get these questions in advance and everyone sort of knows that, but you don't know. You don't necessarily.
Thanks for that, Josh.
But sorry, I couldn't help it. But I mean, I was brainstorming with the team what I should say.
And there focus grouped your answer. So Labour Together. I love it.
Isn't it? We got Thomas the Tank Engine for transport, Doc from Back to the Future for DSIT, Sappho for women. Possibly my favourite was Boudicca for defence. So, and then I thought, actually, seriously, what do I actually think? you know, this will probably sound a bit pretentious, but I am a bit of a classics obsessed person. And I immediately thought it's got to be Cicero. And why? Two simple reasons. One is that he did lots of things. He was a lawyer. He was a historian. But his big thing was always the most important thing I did was politics, was to be a statesman. And I think there's something quite interesting about the extent to which he thought that politics was about being virtuous, being a character of integrity, and explaining that to the people that you were supposed to represent and work with.
But you haven't told us what role Cicero is going to be doing.
Oh, that's true.
Is it going to be like local government? What's he going to be doing?
He'll be speechwriter, surely.
I think he would probably have to be, probably foreign, not defence, foreign. The really interesting thing about Cicero also is that he existed at an age that was transitioning from an age of empire. And I think, you know, one of the really important things that I think are undervalued by think tanks around labor is that geopolitics matters for everything you do in government these days, everything. The kind of tectonic plates of geopolitics are completely shifting right now. And that to deliver for the working people of this country means being serious about understanding.
I'm just imagining sending Cicero to the G20. It would just be fantastic.
Anyway. Wouldn't that be good?
Josh, what is the one policy that you don't think Labour's talking enough about?
I think that the story of how we have come to export submarines around the world, you know, this is not a sort of an election decisive question, this. But I do think that, you know, following on from the last question, we live in a world where defence is very, very important for all sorts of other things, not just a literal question of defending our island. For example, defence is really important for our relationship with Europe. You know, for example, Europe cannot build enough munitions to help Ukraine defend itself without the United States. That is a problem because the United States cannot be relied upon forever to supply the munitions that, you know, a European country needs to defend itself. And we have this great story of, you know, in Labour, actually, not just Britain, but Labour. We said in the last Labour government, you know what, we're going to build submarines in Britain. And then we invested in the, you know, technologies, the spaces, we, you know, rebuilt Barrow. And then we started doing that. And then the coalition government said, you know what, this is too good to lose and to cut. So they didn't. And then in AUKUS, we said, we're essentially going to export submarines all over the world. And that is a great story, I think, of, you know, how a serious strategic look at where the UK can have distinctive strengths and then a sustained long-term investment in those strengths can actually reap very, very long-term rewards that are vital for the kind of geopolitical position of our country.
The final question, what's the test you'd set Keir Starmer's Labour to show that it's in power to change Britain for the better?
The politics that we say we try to build and we try to think of across everything we do in Labour Together is about putting working people first, about delivering for working people. One of the things that I think Labour should really think hard about is what are its metrics for evaluating whether or not it's doing that? Pick, say, four of those metrics and then see over the course of each year in a parliament, are they changing? And if they are, then you're delivering for working people. And I think that will be the political test of Keir Starmer's Labour Party.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. And if you are not a member of the Power Test crew, you can head to thepowertest.co.uk or thepowertest.substack.com. You'll get episodes ad-free and early before anyone else. And there's also an exclusive chance to be part of the podcast and lots more. Also, do get involved with us. If you've got any questions or comments or like ideas you'd like us to explore, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us on pod@thepowertest.co.uk. You can also get involved on social media as well.
And we've also got our brand new YouTube channel, which is a Power Test Pod, and you can find clips on there. The Power Test only exists because of the amazing support from you, our members, and our supporters. And we're also delighted to have the backing of some brilliant organisations like the Future Governance Forum, which is providing intellectual and practical infrastructure vital to the revival of progressive government in the UK, and the Centre for Progressive Policy, a think tank championing inclusive economic growth. We're also really glad to have support from the Institute for Global Change, who provide us with exceptional research and briefings, and also partner with the fantastic Labour List, bringing to life many of the issues, themes and discussions we're covering on the pod.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.